This is ExpertHR.com, your go-to HR compliance resource for federal, state, and municipal law. I'm David Weisenfeld for ExpertHR.com, published by Reed Business Information and proudly partnered with LexisNexis. On this podcast, our focus turns to the trend of alleged wage theft by an increasing number of employers across the U.S. A recent Department of Labor report says workers in California and New York alone lost between $20 and $29 million in weekly income stemming from employer wage theft. And this issue is not limited to the coasts. In northern Ohio, for instance, case filings in federal court over this issue have reportedly jumped 400% in the last decade. But not all of these violations are on purpose. So what's an employer with good intentions to do to avoid finding itself in the crosshairs of a lawsuit for underpayment or non-payment of employee wages? We'll get to the bottom of that question and much more with my colleague Michael Cardman, who heads up Expert HR's coverage of employee compensation and wage and hour issues. Michael, first of all, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you report on a lot of minimum wage violations. Is that what we're talking about when we're using the term wage theft, or is it really broader than that?
Well, it definitely is broader than that. First of all, there's no universally agreed on definition of wage theft. You won't find it in Black's Legal Dictionary. You won't find it in the OED. But a good working definition is that wage theft is any violation of wage and hour laws that results in employee not receiving the wages, the money that they are owed in a timely manner. That's the definition that was used in the very first wage theft ordinance in Miami-Dade County. And I think it's a really good working definition. And a lot of ordinances are modeled off of that definition. But as you can tell, that's something that encompasses a wide variety of different violations. And these are the violations that we've been talking about for a long time that are not necessarily new. Minimum wage, overtime, working time, employee classification, even the timely payment of wages. These are all things that fall under the umbrella of wage theft. And one thing that I think is especially significant about it is that it's a catchy way of talking about these issues. These issues have been around for a long time, but wage theft is a nice new way to really describe them. So I kind of think of it almost like a rebranding when Philip Morris decided to change their name to Altria and start a new paid, turn over a new leaf. Wage theft is a little bit like that. It's a new way of describing something that's been around for a long time.
Nothing like throwing in the word theft to catch people's attention.
It absolutely does. Headline writers across the country, I think, are much more inclined to put in wage theft than they would to something more dry and abstract like wage and hour or minimum wage.
Now, Michael, this is an issue that has gone well beyond just the discussion stage. In fact, a number of states and big cities have enacted wage theft prevention laws. In fact, you just mentioned one with Miami-Dade County. Tell us about some of the most notable laws that you've seen.
Well, to me, the most notable laws would be the local ones, because it's noteworthy that municipalities are adding these laws to the books. We've always had wage and hour laws on the books at the federal level, of course, with the Fair Labor Standards Act, and also state wage and hour laws. But having these local ordinances just adds another layer of complexity. It's another agency that's going to be enforcing these types of laws. And it's another set of laws. And of course, as employers well know, all of these laws have subtle variations that can trip you up. So to me, some of the most significant ones are the ones that are at the local level. So Miami-Dade County, of course, was the first one. But you also see them in some of the usual suspects like San Francisco and Seattle. Los Angeles was considering one, but it never passed. At the state level, there are two that really stick out, and I think that would be New York and California, because New York and California often are at the vanguard of changes in employment law, and their laws were some of the earliest ones, and they've served as a model for other states.
Michael, minimum wage and overtime laws have been on the books for years now. In fact, the Fair Labor Standards Act goes all the way back to the 1930s. So why are we seeing this wage theft
trend and the spate of new laws now?
That's a really good question. And I think one answer can actually be found in that Miami-Dade ordinance. They actually said in a report that came out with the ordinance that they had a sense that the existing laws were not effective enough. And there were a handful of reasons why they thought they weren't effective enough. One is the employee notice requirements, the employee poster requirements. So everybody's worked in a workplace where you see that Fair Labor Standards Act poster on the wall in the break room or by the microwave. These wage theft ordinances really are trying to make much more robust employee notification requirements. So the idea is that the more workers know about their rights, the more inclined they will be to contact a local enforcement agency or contact a local attorney and secure their rights. So the notice part is a big part of it. Another big part of it was the penalties and damages. If they increase the penalties and damages, that's going to add an extra degree of reason for employers to really try to comply with these. And finally, another reason why Miami-Dade and I think a lot of other jurisdictions wanted to do this is to give employees another avenue for accessing the legal system. At the federal level, with the Fair Labor Standards Act, there's a requirement that employees actually opt in to any kind of collective action. And that's something that has sometimes been seen as limiting the ability for employees to file claims. So a lot of these wage theft ordinances give them another avenue that makes it a little bit easier for them to get into the legal system, whether it's at the local, state, or federal level.
You mentioned accessing the courts. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals recently ruled that FedEx had essentially committed wage theft by repeatedly misclassifying its drivers as independent contractors rather than employees. Is that a fairly common mistake from what you've observed?
It's increasingly common, absolutely. The old model where you would go work for an employer for 30 years and then retire with a gold watch and a pension is long gone, and we are seeing more and more employers and employees moving to more flexible models. Unfortunately, for both parties, the law hasn't really kept up with these evolving arrangements. But we're seeing a lot more of them, and because of it, we're also seeing a lot more claims of employees who say they were misclassified as independent contractors when really they should have been treated as employees. One really interesting development on that front is David Weil. He's the administrator for the DOL's Wage and Hour Division. In a sense, he's the new sheriff in town. He's the guy who is in charge of enforcing many federal employment laws, including the Fair Labor Standards Act. And before he became the administrator, he wrote an important report where he analyzed what he calls fissured industries. And he claims that a lot of employers are insulating themselves from wage and hour claims, and especially misclassification claims.
And Michael, tell us, what are fissured industries?
This is as Weil describes it. Ways that these employers try to distance themselves from liability, essentially. It's removing themselves 1 or 2 degrees from the employer-employee relationship. So franchises is a big one, independent contractors, temporary staffing agencies, subcontracting. These are all legitimate business practices, but they sometimes can be taken too far. And Weil has taken it on himself and on the Department of Labor to really put these industries under the spotlight and make sure that when they are classifying someone as an independent contractor, that it really is genuine and not a way to mask the employee-employer relationship.
Michael, shifting gears a bit from a practical standpoint, tell us, what are some steps that HR listeners out there can take to reduce a well-meaning employer's risk of non-compliance?
Well, one really big thing is making sure that an employer is properly counting all hours worked. So we see a lot of claims that involve this. This is called working time or hours worked. So meal breaks are very common. Is an employee completely relieved of his or her duties during a meal break? If not, you need to pay them for that time. Same thing with other issues like on-call time or waiting time, certain forms of travel time that an employee spends traveling on the road for a business trip, things like this. Sometimes they count, sometimes they don't. So it's a good idea to really take a close look at how you're compensating employees. Another thing that comes up, not quite as often with non-exempt employees, but we're seeing a lot of claims involving new forms of communication. So with smartphones now, with email, it's possible for employees to do work when they're sitting at home or when they're sitting on the bus on the way to work, things like this. Something that can really trip an employer up. So it's a good idea to take a look at your pay practices and make sure that anything that might really be work time, that employees are getting paid for that. Another big aspect of it is also employee classification and making sure that any employees you've classified as exempt from overtime laws truly are exempt. This is one of the most difficult challenges for employers. It's especially tricky because employees' job duties evolve over time, and you may have classified them as exempt a year ago, and at the time it may have been the correct decision, but since then maybe they've lost a couple subordinates and they no longer are overseeing two or more full-time employees. Maybe they're no longer exempt as an executive. These kinds of things can really trip you up too, so it's important to keep an eye on these things and do periodic checkups.
That's good advice, Michael, because some employers like Walmart and others have really learned the hard way with the issue of not compensating employees with meal break time, that this is something that can really land an employer in hot water.
Absolutely. The math is really, really scary when you look at it. And the Walmart case is a classic example. You had employees who were just being shortchanged maybe 20 minutes, half an hour a day for unpaid meal breaks. But you take that, multiply it times 5 days a week, multiply that times 52 weeks a year, you multiply that times 2 years, 3 years if it's a willful violation, and then you multiply that again by the number of employees who are affected, then you double it for liquidated damages, and all of a sudden you have a multi-million-dollar settlement on your hands. So it can get really scary for employers really quickly.
We'll let that be the last word. Michael Cardman is the legal editor who heads up our coverage of employee compensation and wage and hour issues. Michael, thanks so much for your insights on wage theft and everything else we discussed.
You're very welcome, David. Thank you.
I'm David Weisenfeld. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. Thanks so much for listening. Continue checking our website for more podcasts on key employment topics affecting the world of HR. Recent programs include What Ebola Means for Employers, plus a look at a key Supreme Court case involving pregnancy discrimination. The opinions expressed in this program do not represent legal advice, nor should they necessarily be taken as the views of Expert HR or its employees. ExpertHR.com is published by Reed Business Information and is proudly partnered with LexisNexis. For more information about Expert HR, our new employee handbook resource, and our subscription offering, call us toll-free at 1-855-973-7847. Again, that's 1-855-973-7847. And if you mention listening to this podcast, we'll give you 20% off a new subscription. Copyright 2014, all rights reserved.